Fiona McIntosh. She's got more than 36 books to her credit. She's even written a book about how to write books. And with the release of The Diamond Hunter, it seems she's finally put a version of her own story onto the page. The Diamond Hunter starts at the diamond mine known as the Big Hole in South Africa, the deepest pit ever dug by human hands, with that little Clementine growing up there watching her father dig in the dirt. How close is that to your childhood?
Interestingly, when I was writing the book, I had no idea. I was actually channeling a bit of my own story. It was only later when my mother read the manuscript. She said, well, you're just writing about yourself, really, which was such a shock. I think I became a bit sort of wild-eyed and crazy at the thought that I'd finally fallen into that trap. But yes, my early childhood was spent in Africa, and my father was working in the gold mines, and I was like this little three-year-old urchin running around this mining camp and into everything, quite precocious, and some supervision, but not as much as we might give our children now. And
it's only a mine.
It's only a mine. There are only snakes out there. It doesn't matter. And it was the bush, you know. It was real. If you wanted to go out, you'd machete your way out, you know, sort of through jungle. So it was really an extraordinary place to grow up. And I had this very great friend who was an African, a Ghanaian. He worked with my father, and he was my very best buddy. And when I first met him, he could only click. And by the time I left 5 years later, he was fluent in English. And I used to teach him everything I learned at on the veranda with my mum homeschooling. And we formed this incredible bond, Odongo and I. And I had no idea when I was writing Clementine and Joseph Wanshu that, in fact, all the emotion that is in that relationship is me and Odongo. So I feel guilty and red-faced, but it's a very beautiful story, and it's okay. I mean, I've written enough books not to feel too sensitive about it.
Did you go back and look at your childhood photos to kind of rediscover this?
Well, no, I didn't know that's what I was writing.
But
it was
afterwards.
Only afterwards. Yes, afterwards I looked at it and I thought, oh my gosh, it's so true. Mum's nailed me on this. I had no idea. But when I was in Africa and researching the story, there was no sense of it at all. I didn't even know I was writing about this little girl. I thought I was writing about her two parents, but she became more and more interesting, and I just cast them aside and thought, actually, you're the main character here. You're quite interesting to play with, and your great friend, who's a diamond digger, a Zulu warrior. So it became their story and all the treachery and drama around the two of them.
I'm just amazed at book, I think, 38. Your mum is still reading your manuscripts.
Yeah, she is. She is. She's 91, and she doesn't read a lot of novels, but she likes to read my manuscript so that she can lord it over her friends and say, oh, look, I read that about a year ago, so keep up, everyone.
Now, Joseph Wanshu is a really lovely character. The reason why he wears only one shoe, is that something you invented? Is that something?
Yes, I invented it. I came up with the name first. I just thought, Joseph One Shoe, it just worked, you know? And I thought, so why has he only got one shoe? And I began to sort of develop that idea that was actually part of his character and his wise ways and
maintaining
sort of
connection to the earth and to his Zulu warrior roots.
Yes, and sort of keep one foot barefoot, never forget who you are, but wear the shoes of the European man because you're working alongside him. It's rather lovely, and it just worked in my head and makes him an empathetic character straight away.
Now, you started writing crime way back when.
No, I started writing fantasy novels.
Well, I knew
novels.
You had written a lot of fantasy. I thought your debut novel was a crime book.
No, it was a fantasy back in year 2000.
Okay.
And I wrote about 14 of those, and then
I remember them very well being in the bookshops.
And, oh, really?
Yeah,
how
yeah.
wonderful. And then I thought, well, I want to do something different. So I wrote a couple of crimes, and then I started writing some children's books, and then finally found my way to where I wanted to always be.
Oh, really?
Always wanted to write.
Why did you start in fantasy if you wanted to write the kind of historical drama romance that you're doing now?
Because Bryce Courtney wouldn't let me. I came and I learned my craft at with him in Hobart. So I came 20 years ago to a course at the university, 5 days long, and Jane Franklin Hall, brilliant, brilliant 5 days of my life with Bryce Courtney, who equipped me with the knowledge of what I needed, the sort of nuts and bolts of putting together a book. But of course, I didn't know. I was just seeking, am I any good at this? And he just said, you're already a writer, you just haven't actually thought about it. So go home and write your book. But he said, Fiona, do not write historical because you're not ready for it. And I didn't know what he meant. And he said, what are you reading at the moment? And I was consuming vast amounts of fantasy books, really high quality ones like Game of Thrones. And he said, write that. You'll know how to write it. So I wrote 14 of those, and then the crimes, and then the children's, and then I thought, I'm ready. And I rang him, and he said, yep, you are ready. You've done your apprenticeship. You've written 20 books. You're ready. And so I wrote the first one of the historicals and never looked back. It's what I want to write.
You're listening to ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. I'm Joel Reinberger. Fiona McIntosh, amazing author, happens to be in Tasmania, born in England, but some growing up in Africa. But we claim her as an Australian because she lives here now.
And you can claim me in Tasmania because my heart is here. I would live here in a blink, given a chance. And we've got a house here in the Huon Valley.
What's stopping you?
Oh, I've got aging mother who needs us and, you know, all of that. So my heart is here, and it doesn't take anything to persuade me to leap on a plane and come down here and visit. And, you know, we've had a place here for about 20 years, so I've... My heart's here.
Now you are writing like the historical fiction and you recognise you are ready for it. Looking back at that you from, you know, 15, 20 years ago, why weren't you ready to write that then? Why did you go to fantasy instead?
Oh my gosh, it takes its pound of flesh, historical. There's so much study to do for each book. Each book takes, it's a run-up of about 2 years to each book. So I'm currently researching the 2021 book. I'm writing the 2020 book and I'm touring for the 2019 book. And you just need that lead time. There's so much study and then you have to go and find all the locations. And because all of mine are set overseas, I have to go to all these places and do what I call due diligence for the reader. And although all the readers are right now saying, you know, that is the most cunning way to travel.
And tax deductible
travel. But I do. I really do. I won't write about any place I haven't been to. And I put my feet on the ground and I eat the food and get to know the people. And I go to all the museums and libraries and archives and learn for 2 years before I write.
Have your fantasy readers come with you into the new world?
They really have. They're very forgiving. They keep waiting. They beg and they plead.
Yes,
we want the screams from the dungeon. How about a few, you know, a bit of clank and armor? But no, I'm very lucky they've come across. And the interesting thing is that the new readership, which is a slightly older, more discerning, I don't mean discerning, they've just will not, you know, try other things. They love these historicals. They're trying the fantasy, which and saying, oh my gosh, these are brutal but brilliant stories, aren't they? Yeah. So I'm loving that we're all going into this melting pot. And also there's the crime books that are re-emerging now because Australians have a voracious appetite for crime books and we're streaming TV about crime and all of that and we're listening to crime stories. And so they've re-released my crime books and it's gone gangbusters. So I'm now having to write more crime.
Oh, okay. So do you have to go and do the same amount of research for a crime book?
Well, I've just come back from London and stomping around an area in London with a policeman, an ex-Scotland Yard guy, who just walked me through what I would need to know to get the protocols right for the 1980s. So I have to carry on from where the last two left off. So
everyone's loving the whole life
the
on
whole
Mars.
80s, but
go back to the 80s and
I
wear
was
the
writing,
collars.
I wrote it. I wrote the first one back in, you know, the day for 2008 or 2007, I wrote the first one, and I wrote it in the 80s because I understood the 80s, being a sort of a young woman in the 80s. And so I just went back to a comfortable, and I also didn't want mobile phones and the internet and all of that gets in the way of a great story.
I got to tell you, you look back at, say, you know, I was a big fan of the X-Files when they first came out. 90% of the problems and drama in the X-Files would be solved with the mobile
Google.
Phone. Yeah. Mobile phone and Google,
you're
done.
Fixed, you're done. And maps and all that. You don't get lost or anything. So I need that pre-technology time. And it's so much more interesting and tense and dramatic. And so we're going to come back with a new Jack Hawksworth soon.
Of all the places that you have been and the kind of the things that you have learned about over time, you know the subject matters that you've managed to cover, what's been the most fascinating discovery for you?
Oh, my gosh. I'll tell you this, and I'm not saying that just because I'm in Tasmania, but I was reading the history of Bridestow, your lavender farm.
The lavender farm, yeah, yeah. Because yeah. you wrote a book about lavender yeah. quite recently,
so,
didn't you?
Well, it was one of my first, and I read its history, and its history is so interesting that I immediately said, I'm going to write a book about this. And I went straight to Provence, got on a plane, went to Provence, and found where the original mother stock of the Bridestow lavender came from. And set me off on this pathway. And The Lavender Keeper is perhaps one of my most popular books, and it sort of opened up the world of historical fiction and really put me on this trajectory to be sort of one of Australia's favourite sort of storytellers. And so I owe a lot to The Lavender Keeper. I owe a lot to Bridestow and its lavender. And it was such a surprising discovery that somebody brought some seeds over from, Provence, these wild seeds, and threw them in the ground in Launceston. And they flourish because they're on the same latitude. Provence and yeah, Launceston yeah. are on the same latitude. And so they flourished where lavender would normally not flourish in another part of the world. So it was just a beautiful serendipitous moment for me, and it's really carved out my career.
In fact, you learned so much about perfume, you released a separate little book about perfume.
And I made a perfume, and the perfume became so popular around Australia because we gave out samples of it to say, this is the perfume I made in the book, and women just scratch their faces off loving that whole connection. And then they loved it so much that I had to manufacture 400 bottles of this stuff and have it flown in and imported. And we had a sweatshop of all my family putting labels on, boxing, bubble wrapping, and getting it out all around Australia.
So what is the recipe for the Fiona McIntosh perfume?
That is a secret. I am not. That is something very special.
All right. What are the notes?
Well done. The notes. There are notes of geranium in there. Mm-hmm. There are notes of vetiver. There are notes of pomegranate in there.
Ooh,
yeah,
I like
there's loads of beautiful, sort of slightly exotic notes in there. Probably a little bit of sandalwood, and then it goes a little bit pretty. There's some violet in there because I had to work with a perfume that could only have been made in 1915. So nothing, I couldn't play with any of the new notes.
Yeah,
it had to be really old fashioned essential oils from the time.
So ambergris from a whale
snout. Who knew that it floated on the top of oceans? And,
essentially it's a whale's hairball.
Yes, something they've sneezed up. You know, it's just learning about that is brilliant. And in fact, I'm taking a group of people because we did a Lavender Keeper tour. People wanted to go. They said, we want to come traveling with you. And I said, all right, I'll put on a Lavender Keeper tour. We went to France and they really believed that Luc existed and Lisette existed. And so I took them to her apartment in Montmartre and they were like,
nice.
Oh my gosh, let's go and knock on the door. And I said, no, you know it was fiction, don't you? And there were all these people just so hysterically excited that we were walking in the footsteps of the Lavender Keeper. So now I've promised I'll do it again, and we're about 6 or 7 or 8 years down the track. And so we're going back to France to make perfume. And my next book is about champagne. And so we're going to go to Epinay and drink gallons of champagne together and learn about all the research I've done for the last few books